Once again, we're happy to welcome to our broadcasting studios Clyde L. Hap Whartney, the Regional Eastern Interbureau Coordinator of Administration for the Northeast States. I presume you're here with your report.
I'd like to preface my remarks by thanking the company for making available to me this free radio time.
Well,
I know how valuable it is, and I appreciate it very much. Bob, if you'll fire away now with the questions that I have prepared for you, I'll be very pleased to answer the questions that I have answered here thoroughly.
All right. Mr. Whartney, do you have any immediate plans for the coming fiscal period in which we're just starting out?
I'm glad you asked me that question. Fiscal has already started, Bob, and we're making great plans for it.
Hap, I wonder if you could give us a little fill-in on what the field representatives have been doing as they have been traveling around New England and the southeast part of Indiana collecting the material which will later be collated for shipment to Washington.
After they are collated, they will be shipped to Washington, where there will be a comprehensive collation done there, and a graph will be drawn so that we'll have a complete picture of everything.
Well, then, after that report is submitted to Washington and returned to you, what do you do with it?
After that report is returned to me, I then give duplicates to all my field workers, who then go about the country talking with the individuals who are most interested in it.
Then what?
After that, we return, or they return to my office, where we make a complete report in graph form and then send it along to the Army Engineer.
It's been a real pleasure having you here, Mr. Whartney, and we certainly will look forward to your next visit when we hope you'll have more information along these lines.
It has been a pleasure, as it always has been, to be here on the National Companies, and thank you.
Thank you, sir.
The current trend in radio, particularly on a local basis, is the use of the beeper telephone to conduct live interviews with people in the news.
Now, there are several advantages to this, such as being able to interview anyone at any time, as long as you can talk to them, call them on the phone, plus the saving in money because extra engineers and announcers are not needed.
So, with a nose for news and eye toward saving a buck, we initiate the Bob and Ray Party Line, a feature on which newsworthy people will be interviewed via the beeper phone.
Ray, who did you say our first party line call would be to?
It's Mrs. Amy Frontweiler, I believe, whose recent magazine article in Clean House and Sidewalk entitled Kids Are a Pain in the Neck has been widely criticized by the nation's parents. Mrs. Frontweiler is the mother of seven children and the freelance babysitter. I think she's listed in the directory.
I have it here. Frumpstein... Here it is, Frumpweiler, Mrs. Amy. The number is Warbucks 52194. And we'll hope to chat with Mrs. Frumpweiler in just a few seconds. It's ringing now.
Hello?
Hello. This is Bob and Ray's party line calling Mrs. Amy Frumpweiler.
Mommy's giving the twins a bath. Do you want to hear me sing the one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple paper leader?
No, sonny, not now. Could you get your mother to the phone, please?
My daddy told my mommy today that the house is always filthy when he comes home.
That's nice, but could you call your mommy now?
My daddy likes beer a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you want to hear a big airplane flying over a cow and dropping a bag of water on it?
I don't believe it,
sir. Splash! I just made it up now.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, you're a good little boy. Will you go and get your mommy, please?
Okay. What's your name, Mr. Donkey Wonky Dookie?
Tell her it's radio's famous Bob and Ray Goulding.
Donkey and Ray Wonky, Collie Mommy Dookie.
Oh, boy.
Bob Wonky.
See, he hung up.
Yes, he did.
Do you have that number again?
Yes, it's Warbucks 52194.
Try it again.
All right. Must have thought I was all through talking to him or something.
Hello? Marvin, put down that vase. Hello.
Hello, Mrs. Frumpweiler. This is Radio's Bob and Ray's party line calling about your magazine article, Kids Are a Pain in the
Neck. Just a minute. Mm. Marvin, I'm not going to tell you again. Put down that vase. Why, you... You go to your room and wait till your father comes home. Hello, what did you... Who'd you say you were? That vase cost $20.
This is the Bob and Ray party line.
Percy, you tell the twins to get back in the tub this minute. I'll be right back. Bob and who did you say?
Bob and Ray. We'll call back some other time when you're not so tied up, all
right? Yes, why don't you? Mary Lou, did you crayon up that wall?
Well, that was Mrs. Amy Frimpweiler, our first interview on the new Bob and Ray party line feature. And tune in next time when another name in the news is called on the beeper telephone.
Let's not do it again. Say, welcome once again to the Bob and Ray Beg Your Pardon Show. As serious news gatherers and reporters, we are prone to mistakes. Well, we did it again. It was reported at this microphone some time ago that a Mr. Hewlett Tuckering was responsible for the disappearance of a Miss Daisy Merge. What we neglected to say was that Mr. Tuckering was a magician and Miss Merge was his assistant. Mr. Hewlett Tuckering, we're sorry.
Don't forget it.
Well, what happened after the kidnapping charges that had been lodged against you as a result of our disclosure at this microphone?
Oh, the usual. I got 10 years in jail. Mm-hmm. Felt that I didn't deserve the sentence, but go fight City Hall.
Well, we're awfully sorry.
Oh, don't be apologetic. You'll become ill if you do. Anyway, it was more Daisy Merge's fault than yours.
What did she do?
Well, we were appearing at this theater in Youngstown, and generally I'd close the act by putting Daisy in the disappearing cabinet. The idea was that she'd fall into the cellar, and I'd meet her after the show, and we'd go out for a bite of food.
Didn't she meet you for a bite?
Well, I found out later that she met the janitor of the theater down in the cellar. I guess they kind of liked each other. They both went off to Pittsburgh.
And, of course, you didn't know that at the time.
No, I thought she disappeared. There's a lot I don't know about magic.
Mm-hmm. Well, we thought she disappeared, too. That's why we reported that at the microphone.
Well, don't fret about it, then. See how easy it is to make a mistake.
Well, now, after you started your jail sentence, why didn't Daisy Merge step forward and admit that she hadn't disappeared?
She did, actually. She came to the prison one day dressed as an old lady selling apples. She said she'd admit she hadn't disappeared if I gave her $5. I didn't have it.
It's a shame.
Yes, it was. She needed the money badly. Her husband, the janitor, was suffering from a dread malady caused by flies.
Well, gee, that's certainly disheartening.
Yes.
But you were suffering in that jail, too, weren't you, as I remember?
Well, it's not too bad if you get a good cell. Mine was under a furnace.
Oh, and I guess no one believed you when you told them that you were innocent.
Well, I protested for a while, but I soon stopped that when they poured hot lead on my elbow.
Well, that's terrible. I feel rotten about all
this. Cut it out. Cut it out. You'll have me crying.
Well, what happened after you got out of prison?
Well, the Magicians Union had taken my card away from me, so I slept in the streets for about 3 months.
And then what happened?
I got sick from sleeping in the streets. There's a way to sleep in the streets safely. You got to stay away from where the water runs down the sewer. I was too weak to do that.
Gee, that's awful. We're so sorry for reporting you.
Stop apologizing. No. I straightened out eventually. There's this very nice guy, CPA, who decided he'd take a chance on an ex-con. Gave me a job sweeping his office.
Well, that's wonderful. And is that where you're working now?
No, he emptied out the safe last night, and I believe the police are looking for me.
Well, Mr. Tuckering, we're not going to report you this time. How's that for being good sport?
That's swell. And about that first mistake, relax. Could have happened to anybody. You find that's why they put erasers on pencils.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Tuckering, and thanks for being with us. And folks, be with us again soon when we try to cover up another one of our mistakes. Wally Ballou is at Gopher Hole, Minnesota this week, where he's with Game Warden Lester Fink, who have a very exciting broadcast for us now. Standing by with our remote equipment way up there in Minnesota, Wally Ballou.
Fink, King of the Forest Preserve here, and we're going to ask him a few questions to do with the whooping crane, which I understand, sir, is just about due.
Well,
we're due to see one for the first time.
Wally, I'd suggest that you talk in hushed tones because we're going to get as close as we dare get to the whooping cranes. They have very sensitive ears, eyes, and noses.
We'll try to speak as quietly as we can. We're standing on the edge of a clearing, and to the far end, there is a water hole, which, as I understand it, is where the whooping cranes meet and whoop it up.
Oh, I stepped right up to my knees and helped me out of this thing.
Yeah.
Right over the top of my boots. Oh, that's an awful feeling.
Yes, yeah, so we'll slosh around with those.
Well, I think right now, if you look through these
bushes, I can't see much of anything.
You can probably see the whooping crane in their famous mating dance.
I wonder if our parabolic microphone can pick up some of the...
Let's just be quiet. I think now, that's the male. You'll hear him dance about, and then he'll cry.
Can we tell the difference between the male and the female by the dancing of their feet?
Yes, well, it's not the... you can't tell the
difference. Well, that, I mean, are the females any lighter on the feet?
Well, I would assume they are, but it would only be an ounce or so different.
Yes.
Now, I want you to listen right here now. You will hear the famous mating call of the whooping crane when the dancing stops.
All right. What happens now?
That's it.
Then we've heard it.
You've heard it? I think probably for the first time.
20 miles into the northern Minnesota forest land by foot, we have been listening to the mating call of the whooping cranes with Assistant Forest Preserve Master Lester Fink. Thank you very much, sir, for taking
this... You can speak right up now loud.
Yeah, I see they don't pay any attention to us at all. I think we could have spoken up this loud all the way through, but we hope you heard it. And,
well, let's start back.
It's a four-day trip back, so...
Come on, let's go. Welcome once again to the Book Review of the Airwaves. Today's guest is Mr. Dylan Bellwether, author of How to Live Longer by Staying Calm in Certain Situations, which demand a good deal of tolerance and foresight. Say, that's quite a title, Mr. Bellwether.
Yes, I got around to it by making my publisher print the book with two front covers. I had to fight them like Billy Mitchell on that count.
Well, I read your book, and I can say it certainly is an aid to people who flare up at the slightest provocation. How long did it take you to write the book?
About 8 years. I know that's a long time to write a book, but you've got to remember that the book runs a good 30 pages, and there were other reasons why it took as long as it did to write.
Well, what reasons, sir?
Well, the wife and kids were around a lot of the time, and that can be distracting.
But, of course, with your background of knowing how to stay calm in emergencies, I imagine you just shrugged off whatever distractions there were and kept
going. Some of them I did, but there were times when I got plenty angry. I'll admit, I once hit my wife with a broom.
Why'd you do that, sir?
Well, she provoked me one day when she asked me for a dollar so she could buy a new dress.
Well, I think any man would have done what you did in the same situation.
Sure they would. And the kids didn't make it any easier either.
Well, how do they try your temper?
Well, I hate kids, so I think I might be a bit prejudiced on the matter. Nothing personal in it, though. Anyway, back in 1956, I was hard at work on my book, and I wanted to get rid of the kids. And I figured most kids seem to enjoy swamps. Get in all that muck, and they seem to have a real good time in it. So I was all for sending the kids to a swamp for the summer, and I sent them to one. 3 days later, they came back begging for food.
Well, that would make any man lose his temper.
Yes, the kids seemed to have an abrasive quality that grated on my nerves. It was a battle, all right.
Well, the important thing is that you finished your book, and it seems to be selling quite well.
Who told you it was selling well?
Well, isn't it on the bestseller list?
No, and it never was. Books on how to calm yourself are a drug on the market these days. And frankly, mister, I'd hoped you'd be a little better prepared for this interview.
Well, I was given the information by one of my research staff. Usually, he's very dependable.
Well, he's dead wrong this time.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Had to fight the midtown traffic to get here. It's a shame you guys aren't more on the ball. I'd just as soon leave right now and let you fill in with organ music. It would serve you right.
Well, now, calm down, Mr. Bellwether. We did the very best
we could. Well, you think so. Let me tell you something right now. You're a clod. You always were and you always will be. I've listened to this program for years, and each time I hear your voice, I break the radio.
Von Monroe does that, too.
Don't get funny with me, mister. One more crack and you'll get a smart rap on the nose.
Well, sir, this is precisely the situation covered in the first chapter of your book, How to Deal with an Unprepared Radio Interviewer After Having Fought Midtown Traffic.
I'd like to rip that chapter right out of the book. It's all nonsense, and so are you.
Thank you for appearing in our microphone, Mr. Dylan Bellwether, author of How to Live Longer by Staying Calm in Situations Which Demand a Good Deal of Tolerance and Foresight.
I must say that Ray and I have been overwhelmed and completely taken by surprise by the reaction to the Thurber Whitechapel telephonic stories which have been coming over the lines the past few weeks, all as a result of meeting him on a tour some weeks back. He went back to his home in North Chicago and has been calling in ever since with little human stories of things that happened to him. He's on the phone now, and Thurber Whitechapel, what is our story about this week?
Hello there, Bob, and hello there, Ray, and hello there, everybody who enjoys my telephonic story.
Well, a great many people do, Thurber. We've had letters and phone calls. People stop us on the street. They say, hey, how about those Thurber Whitechapel phone calls, stories? And we say, yeah, how about it? And they all seem to like them. So I guess we'll have to continue.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. I'd like to tell the story of the time I was on a wine testing tour. It was very interesting, and I thought you might like to hear about that.
Well, it sounds as if it would. If you can just keep it short, that's been our big problem. Your stories do ramble a little bit, and they run over our accustomed time period. So you have about a minute here. If you can tell us a crisp, concise story, wrap it up in a nutshell inside of a minute, we'll be real happy here.
Well, I was on this wine testing tour through Gary, Indiana about 3 years ago. We were trying to find a new white wine that we had heard rumored was being raised and grown there in Gary, Indiana.
You mean the grapes for it were?
I had this old Marmon touring car. I don't know if you're familiar with those cars.
Yes, I remember those.
They were a very, very well engineered automobile, and they're antiques now.
Well, there are several in good operating order. That,
well, this one wasn't. And that's another part of the story. I arrived in Gary, Indiana. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. And I wasn't in the mood to go right out to the famous Gary Vineyards at that hour.
A little too early to test the grape, huh?
Right. So I went in town, and I don't know if I ever mentioned... did I ever tell you about Porky McNichol, a fellow who usually travels with me on these...
No, I don't think you've mentioned him, but I think you're getting off onto another story here. And we are getting the old speed-up signal, which means that we've got to draw this to a close. Can you finish it, or shall we call you back? Because
I think
you'd like
better call me back, because I've got Porky in here now, and he went off on a little side trip that I think is more than interesting.
All right, swell. Thurber, we'll call you back in a little while and see if we can get the wrap-up of your story for this week. Quickly now, let's get on the phone and welcome back Thurber Whitechapel out there in Chicago, who will wrap up the story he began a little while ago.
I dropped the stopwatch, and chances are now I won't be able to keep an accurate
well,
check on this call.
Well, they'll let us know in the control room. Otherwise, they'll just cut us off, and then we'll find out. Thurber, are you there?
Yeah. Well, see, Porky McNichol at this time was driving the Marmon.
And, just to bring the folks up to date, you were on a wine testing tour through Gary, Indiana. Is that right?
That's right.
And Porky was helping you out.
Porky and I were down there trying to trace this particularly delicious white wine.
Now, you said Porky took a side trip, and that was quite interesting.
Right. He let me off at, do you know Gary at all?
Not at all. No, I don't.
Well, it's a very nice city, and he let me off downtown in Gary, and he said, I'm going to take a little side trip, Thurb.
That's what he called it,
That's what he called me, Thurb.
I mean, that's what he called what he was going to do, a side trip.
A side trip. And he said, I'll meet you back here in about an hour, an hour and a half. I said, well, don't hurry back. I said, I'm tired now from the long trip from north of Chicago down to Gary. It isn't too long a trip, but it was enough to tire me.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
I said, don't hurry back, Porky. I said, I'm going to go up to the hotel room now to check in. I'll check in for you. And,
get another stopwatch.
I'll bring the luggage into the hotel. I said, and I'll get a little rest. I said, chances are that maybe today I won't feel like going out to the vineyards.
Well, get that other stopwatch.
Maybe I'll get the rest. And tonight maybe could go to a movie or something. And then tomorrow, get up early and go right out to the famed vineyards where we hope to trace this white wine I was speaking of.
Wonderful. Good news. Thanks, sir.
With that, I got out of the Marmon, and he handed, we have it's an old-fashioned touring car, this Marmon, and we have the luggage on the running boards. And just as I reached to take this handbag off the running board, he put it into reverse gear and let the clutch out rather rapidly. So it turns out I made this side trip with him.
Oh, I see. You took the trip together and... did you find the new kind of grapes or whatever it was?
And he didn't know I was with him.
Oh, I see. Thurber, here again we've run into the old problem of just no more time.
Yeah.
But maybe next week you can call back and continue it. Maybe not. Who knows?
Well, thank you, and I'm awfully glad that these are being so well received by the people across the country.
Well,
I think
those
are very interesting stories, and for all that...
Oh, excuse me, we're on the air here now, Bob.
Gee, I didn't see that coming at all.
Right here we wanted to go over the lost and found items. We do this every once in a while. People who visit us here at the tour have left things behind, and every once in a while we go on the air with the list. Now, you have until 5 o'clock the following day to get here and claim your item.
All you have to do is identify it, identify yourself, and the item is yours. We want you to get back the things that you have lost, of course. Now, what do we have?
We have one fireless cooker
mm-hmm.
that was left here.
That was left about 2.5 weeks ago, I think.
That's right. It's in fairly good shape. And if you could, there's a serial number on it. If you come and give us the serial number, the fireless cooker is yours.
Here is a model storm window. Evidently, a storm window salesman came through here on a tour with his little miniature storm window. It's in perfect working condition. It shouldn't be of any particular value to anyone other than a storm window salesman. But if it is yours, please come and claim it.
We have one... Well, that appears to be a cowbell. I don't know whether that was lost or it's up here from sound effects. But if you could come and claim it, it's yours. We also have one of those space shoes. It's the left one. And there's a cut in the side for a bunion.
Naturally, this would only fit 1 foot, probably, because they're all molded, of course, to individual feet.
Obviously, this person's foot's changed after he got his space shoes a little. We have a geranium plant that's in full bloom.
Now, this would be very difficult to transplant, of course, but in the pot, it is in good shape, as good as we found it, of course.
And we have 4 star rubies that in a setting with the diamonds. These, I'm afraid, nobody would be able to
identify. And, of course, as is the custom, anything that you can't identify becomes our property. Oh, and there's an original... Matisse.
Another original Matisse. This I'm sure you cannot identify either. Okay, that's the lost and found for this week. If you've lost anything here, you be sure to listen for this little feature from time to time. How you doing, weather fans? Time now to take a look at it. The weather, that is. And to call in the Bob and Ray official weather forecaster, who is stationed atop Mount Washington in the state of New Hampshire. Come in, please, Clifford Fleming.
It's summer, Dave, and we certainly are enjoying it. I hope that all of your weather fans will be taking advantage of the warm sunshine and the blue skies overhead and the green grass underneath.
Well, that's where it usually is. Cliff, tell me, what is the general outlook now for the next few days?
Dave, we look forward to some very pleasant weather. Weather for beach going, for picnicking, for driving in the country, Dave, and all like of that.
I hear the whistle again, indicating that you...
The mountain fever, Dave.
Coming down with mountain fever. How long has it been since you've been down to sea level?
Dave, I think it was sometime in May was the last time.
Uh-huh.
And,
I think it probably would be a good, maybe a preventative practice for you to maybe every 2 weeks climb into your little go-kart and come down the side of the mountain to sea level so to avoid this mountain fever. Yeah, and I
said...
I know, I heard you.
Well, anyway, Dave, I hope that you'll be able to take some time off, that you and the missus and everybody up there in the big city will be able to enjoy the weather we're giving them.
How is Miss Fleming?
Miss Fleming is fine, Dave. Sends her best to you.
Well, give my best to your War Department, too. And it's been nice talking with you, Cliff, and I gather then that we'll have nice weather for a while.
That's about the size of it, Dave.
Okay, you've been listening, Cut It Engineer, to Clifford Fleming, Bob and Ray's private weather forecaster, stationed atop Mount Washington in New Hampshire.
We have a gentleman here at the microphone now who claims to have a very interesting occupation. What did you say your name was, sir?
Eldon Driftbank.
And what is the occupation, please?
I'm a lake remover.
Well, what does that job entail, Eldon?
Well, for different reasons. People sometimes want lakes removed. I do the job. I'm in business for myself.
You have a store?
No, just a pump. That does the trick just about as well as anything.
Is this a well-paying job?
No. Actually, it's a losing proposition. There are a lot of expenses involved in removing a lake.
Mm-hmm. Expenses of what sort?
Well, the thing is, when you remove a lake, it had better be in the right direction.
Well, why is that?
Well, suppose I removed a lake, say, 100 yards from where it was. There'd be a new lake where there wasn't one before, right?
I suppose so, yeah.
Well, now, the lake would be sitting on another man's property, and suppose he didn't like the lake.
Well, I see what you mean. You'd have to remove the lake again if somebody didn't like where you put it.
That's the idea.
What happens in a case like that?
Well, nothing to do but just keep on going.
With the same lake?
That's right. It can get pretty rough sometimes. There was one time a man in Texas asked me to remove an unsightly lake from his property. Well, I was got down there and got to moving that lake around, and there were a lot of people who didn't like where I put it. And I can tell you, I was kept pretty busy for a while.
Well, I don't see why people would object to a lake. I should think it would add to the real estate value of their property.
Well, this lake I was fooling with at the time wasn't really a decent-looking lake. It was all muddy. Didn't have any fish in it. It was no good for swimming or anything.
Uh-huh. Well, what happens when you remove a nice-looking lake?
Nothing. It just stays there, and people go fishing and swimming in it. In a case like that, my job is done. Some of those satisfied people were pretty nice to me. One of them invited me into his house for a limeade.
Well, that was very kind of him. Oh, can you remember what the toughest job you ever had as a lake remover was?
Well, there was this rotten-looking lake in Miami, Florida. Mm-hmm. And the owners couldn't stand to look at it, so I was called in. I started to remove the lake in a northerly direction.
And I guess with a rotten lake like that, you had to keep going, huh?
I sure did. Lucky thing I had my trailer with me. I did plenty of traveling that year.
Where did the lake eventually wind up, sir?
In Hudson's Bay in Canada. It was quite a trip.
Must have been. Well, what happened when you got to Hudson's Bay? Did you find somebody who was satisfied with the lake?
No, that was a bad lake. For a while, I thought I'd have to go straight on up to the Arctic Circle, you know, with that baby. But the weather turned cold, and the lake froze. So I just picked up the pieces and threw them into a trash can. Good riddance, too.
Well, if the ice thaws out in the summertime, is it going to be your responsibility to remove it again?
Well, why don't you leave well enough alone, huh? Haven't I had enough trouble as a lake remover?
I guess you have had your troubles.
That's right. No home life at all.
Well, thanks for appearing with us here at our Bob and Ray microphone, Mr. Driftbank, and why don't you go for a swim?
A very interesting remote broadcast now from Orient Point in Boston, where Wally Ballou is standing by to tell you all about it. Come in, please, Wally Ballou.
Videos ever traveling Wally Ballou at Orient Point in Boston, Massachusetts, at the home of the rubber chopstick in America. Happy Charlie's Joke Factory, and Charlie is standing here with me now to explain some of the things that are turned out daily here for export to the Orient. Charlie, you are known as the king of the rubber chopsticks, is that right?
That's right. We make all kinds of things here, little gags and things that sell very big in the Orient.
Is that so? Certainly we've stumbled on an unusual branch of fun-making, I would say. How long have you been in business here?
Since the war. I got the idea when I came home one time, and some of the kids had put those rubber fried eggs on a plate for me.
Oh, yes. I've seen those in our old joke shop.
That's right. It gave me the idea that there's plenty of jokes in this country, like rubber, chocolate, and things like that.
Yeah.
But maybe in other parts of the world I could, you know, merchandise some of these items that would be peculiarly needed there.
So you've adapted the idea for export items for the Orient, like the rubber chopsticks, which I imagine caused a great laugh.
That's
somebody
right.
Somebody tries to pick up their...
We have a new item on the chopstick now, Mr. Ballou, that is going to be, I think, even bigger than the rubber.
What's that, Happy?
It's hinged in the middle, a little hidden hinge. In the middle of the chopstick.
In the middle of the chopstick, so it just breaks away there.
It just kind of breaks away as they bring it up, bring the food up to their mouths.
What are some of the other things you turn out here that get big laughs of the inscrutable East?
Well, we have some plastic spare ribs.
That's a good one.
It looks real genuine, and I understand that that's a popular number over there, too.
I understand, too, that you told me you make exploding opium pipes. Is that another of your items you...
That's right. We have a little hidden charges in there, like a cap that blows up.
Gets a big laugh.
We have plastic egg roll with shredded plastic filling.
Boy, I'll bet that's hard to detect until you take a good bite of it.
We're going to take it off the market. A lot of them are eating them.
Oh, yeah. Well, you would run into that kind of trouble, but it's all in the spirit of good, clean fun. And maybe you could expand your activities to other countries, like Germany or Norway, something like that.
Or Italy.
Or Italy.
I mean, I can visualize it.
Plastic pieces.
Or lasagna.
Yeah.
There's a crying need for this, Wally, and I think that I've got something going good for myself here.
Good. Happy Charlie, thank you very much. In the interest of good, clean fun around the world, this is Wally Ballou at Orient Point.
Page 4, Entertainment. And here are Claude and Clyde McBeebe, the McBeebe twins, and their orchestra. Hi, fellas.
Hello there, Bob and Ray.
It's good to be back here in the big city.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and I presume that you're right in the middle of your busy season, traveling from town to town with your new augmented orchestra, the new sound of the McBeebes.
The new sound of the McBeebe's, Bob, is the bell on our custard truck.
What is what?
The bell.
The bell.
On our custard truck.
You're driving a custard truck?
Right. The music business just will not support a large organization such as ours. Whereas people will support a custard truck.
Well,
in the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood. In this warm weather, of course. The frozen custard, I presume, is what you're talking about. It's a very welcome sight to see that wagon, but it's quite
vanilla,
a far jump.
Chocolate. And strawberry.
Fruity. What?
Strawberry.
Fruity.
Strawberry.
Let's get together.
Fruity.
It
is fruity fruity
this week.
It'll be strawberry next week.
You're kind of jumping the gun on the specials there, I guess. Do you find that you miss getting up there on the bandstand every night and waving the old batons and...
The one who isn't driving. gets up on the seat and leads the bell with a baton.
Well, it's must look rather humorous. I suppose it does attract business, though.
It does. We're a welcome, happy sight when we turn up Pine Street. About quarter to seven at night. Right up by the firehouse. We sell probably 11 or 12 right there.
Well, that's...
7 cents.
7 cents. How much do you... how does your take from the custard wagon, for instance, compare with your take on the road with a big band? Can you give us any figures?
Yes. If you go back to the Halcyon days of name band, when we had our name band. We used to make $3,000 to $8,000 a night. Now, of course, we make $15 to $20 a week.
What's the difference? A week. Well, that is a rather difference, but you're happy.
We've adjusted to the cut in income, and we're now finding happiness in other things.
Needing a lot of ice cream. Okay. I hope that maybe things will look up for you and that you'll be back there swinging out with that new sound.
Well, only time can tell. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Here now, two old friends of ours, two of the nation's great big band names, and two of the biggest names in the frozen custard business today, the McBeebe twins and their orchestra. Hi, Phone.
Hello again, Bob. Ray, it's great to be back at the old microphone, filling you in on the activities of the McBeebes.
Well, you fellas have certainly got a nice tan. I guess you've been out with the ice cream truck every day that we've had all the sunshine.
Oh, that's right, in the evenings. We have a canvas top over the cab pie of the custard truck. And we get a lot of sunshine, a lot of fresh air. We've also expanded our activities.
That's all.
We have a small griddle where we can whip up a hot dog in a bun.
Well, that's good. That should double the income, and maybe you can even start
with
a fleet.
Or without mustard.
Maybe you can have a...
Pick a lily.
A fleet of these things. Maybe you've started on a business that'll turn out to be even more successful than your famed orchestral group.
Well, that, of course, is in the back of our minds. And if we can expand, get two or three trucks. Of course, we'd need drivers. How about you and Ray, Bob?
During the week. Well,
I know you're busy here. Yes, it's a lucrative field beckoning to you.
Well, I appreciate the offer. I'll speak to Ray about it when he turns up, but I don't think I would count on it if I were you. We do have to sit around and do a lot of writing and preparing. Staff meetings, board meetings, things like that, even though we are only on the air these few hours, you see.
Well, can we look for you next Monday in that case?
Well, I guess so. As I said, I'll speak to Ray and I'll give you a call.
Well, glad to have you aboard.
For the pie wagon. The McBeebe twins and their custard pie wagon. And we'll report to you later on how we made out.
So long, and 78.
We have a gentleman now at the microphone who claims to have a very interesting occupation. What's your name, sir?
Elihu Torpid. I was born in Burbank, California. I'm 32 years old and unmarried, and I believe I'll be in city for about a week.
Thank you, Mr. Torpid. You certainly are a broadcaster's dream. However, I'm certainly glad you left out your occupation because that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, go ahead. You'll find me amenable. That's what I'm here for.
Well, you're certainly chatty. I guess if all guests cooperated the way you do, I'd be out of a job.
Oh, no. You won't find me malicious or anything like that.
At any rate, will you tell our listeners what you do for a living?
Certainly. I'm a monster maker. You know all those frightening guys you see in the movies all made up? Incidentally, they really aren't monsters. They're people made up to look that way.
Well, I suspected that. How did you ever happen to get a job like that? I mean, you don't see many want ads and that sort of thing.
Well, no, you don't. Well, I was raising ferrets out in Burbank, and I found there wasn't much money in it, so I decided to make a switch.
What did you do then?
Well, as you know, there are quite a few movie studios out in Hollywood. I don't know if you know that.
Yes, I did.
So I visited one of the studios, Bad Looking Pictures. They specialize in monster films. They gave me a job making up monsters.
Well, you didn't have any experience, sir. How did you manage to get the job?
There are ways. It's been my experience that if you can keep your mouth shut and your nose clean, there's very little a man can't do. Well, let me put it to you this way. Aren't there a great many people around today working at jobs they don't know anything about? Admit that, will you?
Well, if you put it that way,
I'm right.
I guess so, Mr. Torpin. But now, how did you go about making up a mind?
Well, now, that depends on the picture. If it's local Earth stuff, and by that I mean werewolves, vampires, or Frankenstein monsters, it's easy because I got something to go on. I know what they look like. For example, a werewolf can pretty much be copied from a cat's face.
Mm-hmm.
And then all I got to do is get out the hair and the celluloid teeth, and I got the job with.
You actually make it sound easy,
sir. Well, it is, up to a certain point. It's the monsters from outer space that give me all the trouble.
Oh, why is that?
Well, use your head, man. There's no starting point when I make up a monster from outer space. Nobody knows what they're supposed to look like.
Oh, I see. Well, what do you do in a case like that?
Well, I make them up out of my own head. I got a commendation from L.B. Overmeyer in the last one I did. In this picture, the Martians land here and don't have any brains.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my job to show that they didn't have any brains.
Oh, that must have been quite a challenge. How did you do that?
I made their heads out of plate glass, and you could look right in, not even see a single brain cell. It was a coup, all right. It
certainly was. I've got to admire you for your ingenuity. I suppose your services will be in great demand when this picture is released.
Ordinarily, I would agree, but this picture isn't going to be released.
Why not?
Well, the story department fumbled this one. Now, how can the Martians land here in spaceships if they don't have any brains?
Yeah, the studio does have a problem there.
You bet they do.
Well, thank you for being with us anyway, Mr. Torpid, and I certainly hope the studio finds a solution. Thank you.
And now time for another remote broadcast with Wally Ballou. This time, Wally is in Clinton, Massachusetts.
Into Massachusetts, down the Dashua River, this is Radio's Wally Ballou. We've brought our radio equipment here to cover the annual Gertie's Regatta, which is an event of local interest, but one which we feel everyone else should have a cognizance of. I'm standing on the banks of the Dashua River, which looks somewhat muddy at this particular point, probably due to several of the viewers having tripped further up the river and riled up the mud just a bit. Gertie is over here, and I've been promised a few words, Gert. You are somewhat of a local character, is that right?
Well, that's right. Most people think of me for one of those local nuts, but I do good things.
Well, you're lovable.
Thank you.
And they have named this annual event after you, of course. Can you tell us a little bit about the regatta and what we can look for?
Well, Gertie's regatta started back in 1905. So that would make it
53 years old.
Is it really? And right now, as you can see down here from your vantage point, the famous dinghy relay is on.
I see. That's the opening portion of the entire day's activities.
That's right. Then we have a regular raft race. Some of the local youngsters have built their own rafts, and they go by several times, and one of them goes by the fastest, according to our stopwatch.
Are they permitted to
is the winner, and will receive the Gertie Lloyd Trophy.
Wonderful.
That will be engraved to the winner. His name will be on it, and then my name will be on it in the year.
Are they permitted to use sails on the rafts, or...
No, they have to use either a long pole or a paddle of some sort. Sails are out.
And then tonight, to celebrate, there's a big bean supper, I understand.
Yes, and then, of course, the famous regatta dance at the Armory.
Certainly is a day that all of Clinton looks forward to, and all of the devotees of this type of sport turn out for. We've been getting Gertie's regatta story here in Clinton, Massachusetts, and our thanks to all who made possible this radio broadcast. Now we'll pack our equipment.
Welcome now to the Bob and Ray Geriatrics Corner, the feature that attempts to create better understanding between employers and some of our senior citizens. Employers would do well to hire some of these people
Isn't that right, elderly Mr. Elmer Garvis?
It was right during the days of the Cleveland Gold Rush, too.
Cleveland?
Yes, not too many people know about that. Did you know that silver was once discovered in Philadelphia?
No, I didn't. Sir, may I first respectfully ask your age?
Well, I'm a bit vain about that. Let's just say that I'm over 98 and under 120.
Well, Mr. Garvis, to what do you attribute your reaching the age of 98 or over?
Work. Keep working. Right now I'm doing some freelance longshoreman work down on the docks.
Wasn't that kind of strenuous work for a man of your age?
Well, if you know how to swing a bailing hook, there's a trick to it, you know.
What is the trick?
You can go whistle in your hat, sonny.
I understand, sir. Mr. Garvis, are you married?
No, I divorced my wife about 80 years ago. Actually, the divorce isn't legal yet. I'm waiting for the final papers to come through.
Then you'll be a free man.
Free as a bird.
Is there any chance for a reconciliation, do you think?
Not as far as I'm concerned. I met her recently in a Cuban hotel. That's when we were having the trouble down there about a battleship that was blown up.
Mm-hmm.
She carried on and all like that about her wanting to stay married, I mean. So I got her a job on a sugar plantation instead, and I've had no trouble from her since.
You mentioned before that you were doing freelance longshoreman work. Do you look for other jobs in your spare time?
Yes, I do.
Do you find employers hesitate in hiring a man over 98?
They sure do, yes.
Well, what do you think the reason for that might be?
Well, it's hard for me to say. Just last week, I applied for a job as a typist and got turned down.
That seems unfair.
Not really. You see, I don't type at all. But when you get on, the idea is to keep busy. Ephraim Stoker taught me that. Boy, he works like a beaver.
Who's Ephraim Stoker?
Well, he's a friend of mine, twice as old as I am, and he really gets around.
What sort of work does he do?
He's in show business. I believe he's scheduled to appear here at your own Latin Quarter next week.
Boy, it's hard to believe a man that old can be in show business. What kind of an act does he do?
Well, first he comes out and shows some relics from the old days. Muskets, powder horns, things like that. And then he hits them with the one line in his act.
What does he say?
Well, it's more for historians than a nightclub audience, but he tells them that at the Battle of Yorktown, General Cornwallis had rickets and was unfit to fight.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Garvis. And incidentally, do you want to be driven home in a magnificent limousine provided by the self-drive people?
No, I think I'll run up to Washington Heights. That's where I live.
Well, suit yourself, sir.
And welcome once again to the Bob and Ray Beg Your Pardon Show. As serious news gatherers and reporters, we are prone to mistakes, of course. Names and addresses can be quite important in reporting a story. We get it wrong a lot of the time. And sometimes people's lives are affected by these minor lapses. And so we thought a public apology to some of the innocent people who were hurt by our irresponsible reporting deserved a public apology. And we have one of these damaged people with us today. Mr. Edgar Forney, we're sorry, sir.
Well, that's all right.
Right here, I'd like to tell our listeners that we erroneously used Mr. Forney's name in connection with a bank holdup 6 years ago. The man who held up the bank was a Mr. Edgar Forley. Tell us what's happened since that time, Mr. Forney.
Well, of course, the police had already arrested the right man.
Well, that was a break for you,
I suppose so, but my neighbors gave me a pretty rough time. They started booing and hissing me, and later I was stoned by them.
Well, we're sorry to hear about that.
Oh, it's all right. It's all in the game. I don't trust a man who's never made a mistake anyway.
Well, what happened after that?
Well, I lost my job at the department store. A lot of angry people threw bolts of silk at me in that instance.
I hope you'll forgive us.
Oh, it was an honest mistake. Forget it. The important thing is, you meant well, and that counts for a lot. Anyhow, after that, I had to move to Cleveland. I wanted a fresh start.
What happened there?
It seems they'd heard of me out there, too. So, to avoid being hit by things, I kind of had to hide out. Took an apartment between the third and fourth floor of a house.
Gee, I don't know what to say.
Don't blame yourself. Thing is, it wasn't so great in the hideout. I had to stay there 24 hours a day.
Well, how did you eat?
I didn't for a long time. I got pretty sick. Landlady discovered me on the floor one day. I asked her to call a doctor, but she recognized me and called the immigration authorities instead.
You know, I feel rotten about that.
Don't start pitying yourself. It can get you in trouble.
Well, what happened then, sir?
I was deported to Vienna. That's the city of waltzes, you know.
So I've heard. Did they know you there?
Yes, but I wasn't stoned there. Quite a few of the people took canes to me, though.
That's a shame. What happened after that?
Well, I bummed around quite a bit, trying to find a place where I wasn't known.
Well, what are your plans now that you're back here in the States?
I really don't know. I might settle in St. Petersburg, Florida. Most of the people who live down there are well into their 80s. They're a little too weak to do much damage.
Well, is there any way we can make up for what's happened to you? We readily admit that it was all our fault.
Look, mister, stop blaming yourself. Keep on doing that, you're going to have a breakdown. What's done is done. Forget it.
Well, in that case, all we can do here on the Beg Your Pardon show is offer a public apology. And we humbly do so. We're sorry, Mr. Edgar Fawley.
I accept your apology, and incidentally, the name is Forney, not Fawley.
I'm sorry. And be with us again
same
next
mistake
week,
you
folks,
made the first
when we try to cover
thing.
Up another one of our mistakes.
Our researchers have come up with another very unusual occupation, and to tell us about it, will you step up to the microphone, Mr. Edgar Verfile?
Well, I'm glad you said it was an occupation. There are lots of people who would call it an avocation. There's a difference, you know.
I know it. Mr. Verfile, would you tell the listeners at home what you do for a living?
Sure. I'm a movie wit. Organizations hire me to haul the different sayings in the movie house to pep things up.
Well, like what, sir?
Well, like in a war picture, say there's a destroyer chasing a submarine, and the commander of the destroyer gives an order to throw out a few depth bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as soon as the depth bombs are released, I holler, "Look out! Here they come!"
You just shout it out, is that it?
Well, I give it more emotion in a movie house. Well, you can understand that.
Yes. What happens when you do shout like that?
Well, it intenses the audience, gives them a few laughs. And we can all use a few laughs.
Yes.
Oh, well, there are a few people who complain to the usher, but he's usually told in advance that I'm there as a professional, so I'm left alone.
When did you last work at your job, sir?
Last night at the Bijou Theater down in Baltimore. I was hired by a fraternal organization known as the Blue Knives of Maryland, and a tougher job I never had.
Oh, that's so? How come?
Well, it was a movie called Camille that was playing there, and we all thought it was one of those French imports from the sound of the name, you know. But it wasn't. It was a very sad movie about a girl with a cough.
I think I saw that one.
Well, it put the organization in a pretty bad mood, see. Everybody was getting restless. A few were even weeping softly, and it was up to me to stop that sort of thing.
Gee, from what I remember about the picture, there were very few openings for the sort of thing you do.
Yeah, it was tough. I finally had to resort to one of the oldest tricks in my business.
What was the old trick you resorted to?
Well, in this picture, see, this girl with a cough has a pretty steady boyfriend who keeps coming around to see her. And about the only thing I could do was when the boyfriend kissed her, I made a loud kissing noise.
Oh, I've heard that done many times in various movie houses.
Well, I just told you it was an old trick. Well, I'll tell you one thing, though. It sure broke the bad mood of the organization. After that, they laughed at everything and had a wonderful time.
Boy, I can see why your job must keep you pretty busy, sir.
Well, I see as many as 50 or 60 movies a week. It keeps me hopping, but it gets rougher every day. I remember back in 48, all I had to do to get an audience crazy was to pretend to snore during an action scene. But they want more these days. And then there are the non-pro guys in the movie house who make people laugh on their own, you know?
Yeah.
When that happens, the organization doesn't pay me.
Well, it sounds at best like a slender situation to me. Why don't you branch out into the legitimate theater field?
Well, I tried that once several years ago at a musical called Carousel. I let go a loud raspberry during one of the songs some guy was singing. And you never saw such a commotion. I was being flogged by theater programs until an usher came along and saved me. Now, there's nothing there for me. I gotta go. I'm due to pep up a picture called The Ten Commandments. You know anything about the story?
Yeah, I don't think you better make any noises at that one, though. But thanks for being with us today, Mr. Verfile, and very good luck in the near future to you.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? How do you do? It's a real pleasure to be back here with you, and today we're going through some lost and found items that have managed to sift through to the Bob and Ray desk, which, of course, abuts the foot clinic.
The summer season, of course, is always great for visitors, and unfortunately for some of them, they have in great abundance left things around, which, as we say, are here on our lost and found table.
Here's something here that could be of some value to the person who left it, I'm sure, is a bag, an insulated bag filled with mushrooms. Of course, there's the possibility that they are toadstools, and we don't want to eat them ourselves,
This would be a problem.
They are highly perishable. So will the toadstool fancier or the mushroom eater who left their
products here. Please call for it by tonight midnight.
Another item here, Ray Goldsmith. It's probably something of great value. I don't know just how much. It's an original publisher's edition of Walden's Pond, and it has Thoreau's autograph in it.
Bob Ahrens, we have something else here that I think it's a charcoal cooker. It's a small one. With looks like it would probably do maybe a half a dozen hot dogs or three or four rather plump hamburgers.
Well, if anybody wants to get any use out of that before the summer's over, they'd better claim it right away.
There's a fifth of Old Tanglefoot. It's an American bourbon type of refreshment that was left here. And well, the rightful owner will pass by, give the serial number of it. I'm sure they can have it back.
We still have, and we have had for the past several months, this picture of Frank Gallup that nobody seems to claim. And it's in fairly good shape, the picture. And it is yours if you merely can identify it. It has something written on it which you can identify.
There is a pencil, a wooden
That's mine. And that is about it. I think we've got... all the items listed here, and all you have to do, you know, is drop us a line, and we'll get in touch with you.
Welcome to the used car lot of the air.
Yes, today's the day we're going to wheel and deal.
Ray, what good buys are there on the lot today that are going begging because of foolish resistance on the part of the consumer?
Well, we have a 1924 Hupmobile that's been on the lot for a while, and the low price on this model is only $12,000. Now, this is a steal. Automatic wheels, removable fenders, self-oiling seats. It's really something you can't afford to overlook.
Isn't that the model that comes with a picture of Calvin Coolidge on top of the gear shift stick?
By golly, I think you're right, pal. Mm-hmm. And that alone makes it an irresistible buy. Incidentally, this car was once owned by Fanny Warden, the heiress.
Really?
Yes.
What?
Yeah, and legend has it that she used to hide all her money in the gas tank.
Golly, I didn't know that. Let's look in the tank now.
No, whatever is in the tank belongs to the buyer of this beautiful, magnificent, mechanic-gone-over Hupmobile. Truly, it's a car that will give you many, many happy hours of motoring in your driveway.
Ray, should I tell them about our next giveaway? Or let them think about that one for a while?
No, you don't. That's my own car, and I refuse to give it up. But I see you're chafing at the bit, so go ahead and tell them.
Well, this happens to be Ray Goulding's own personal car. And wild horses have been dragging it away.
So, no, I think you meant wild horses couldn't persuade me to give up the car.
Or whatever I meant. We're wheeling and dealing on it. It's a foreign import, an Italian libretto, and a real beauty. Seats 1.5 people with ease, gets 300 miles on a gallon, and a special fixture prevents the car from going down a sewer while driving in this city.
Yes, this Italian import is striking to the eye, too. It stands a neat 14 inches above the ground, and you'll find the disposable clay wheel handy, too.
And the handsome interior, lined with specially buffed sandpaper seats, will give you a ride you won't soon forget.
Yes, and you'll find that the non-working speedometer in the libretto will save you many hours of needless worry.
And, too, you'll be interested in the automatic oil reminder. When you're running low on oil, the engine lays a piston in your lap.
And say, Bob, did you want to tell them the color of the car?
Sure. It's a beautiful, colorful, monotone gray. A color selected by the Duke of Alba to match the interior of his son's playroom.
And now, how about the price, pal?
We're charging $60,000 for this spirited little number, and it's worth twice that much, but...
What?
But since the average motorist has little use for a gold-filled crankshaft, we're willing to remove it at great sacrifice to ourselves and replace it with a wooden one.
And that would lower the price considerably, wouldn't it?
Yes. It would drop the car down to the range of the average buyer, $412.
Well, gee whiz, do we have to sell it for that little?
Afraid so, Ray. And if the Duke of Alba knew about this, he'd challenge me to a duel.
And I wouldn't blame him. So, folks, be sure to visit our easy-to-find car lot. And for those of you who are now driving cars purchased at our lot, drive carefully. We know what we're talking about.